Coming up, an interview in 5 minutes. An interview with Charles Key, the head of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. And until then, I'm going to play a couple of clips on the topic of the Oklahoma City bombing. The first thing you're going to hear is a tape recording of the bombs going off. This is from a woman recording a business meeting in an office across the street.
With regard to this proceeding, basically there are four elements that I have to receive information regarding.
CBS News poll out this morning finds 53% of Americans believe questions about what happened in Oklahoma City will continue.
The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing have been given not vengeance, but justice. Due process ruled. The case was proved. The verdict was calmly reached. And the rights of the accused were protected and observed to the full and to the end. Under the laws of our country, the matter is concluded. Life and history bring tragedies, and often they cannot be explained.
We ask some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know. Where the hell were they?
Based on a sketch of two men believed to be the bombers. One sketch showed a dead ringer for Timothy McVeigh, but John Doe number two, according to the FBI, turned out not to exist. So authorities focused their attention on Timothy McVeigh, who was charged with the crime just 2 days after the bombing.
Oh my God, another bomb.
Let's take a look now, if we could. I understand we just received videotape in a news conference held just a few moments ago at St. Anthony's Hospital.
Okay. This is Tom Coniglione. He's medical director of St. Anthony Hospital. This is Jim Maravich. He is chief operating officer and executive vice president of the hospital. I'll give you their cards after the conference is over so you'll know the spelling.
Doctor, can you tell us the situation?
The situation at the present time is that we have treated more than 56 injuries. There have been several more since last count. At the present time, the medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area. I've been told by the police department that just as soon as those bombs are defused, they will permit the medical teams to enter. And once the medical teams enter, we expect quite a large number of rather badly injured individuals being brought here.
But there were more bombs set to go off, according to ATF officials.
It's been about 5 hours now since that first explosion occurred, almost 5 hours exactly. You probably, if you were in bed at the time that it rattled you around, you looked at the alarm clock, you'll remember the time, and you will certainly now remember April 19th, 1995. But 5 hours since, and because of these renewed concerns about new devices, 5 hours in, they are still really not able to get the rescue effort into full swing.
Devin, we're getting more word on that car bomb now. Let me just read this straight from the wire. You talked about it a minute ago. The head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms now says it appears it was a car bomb with as much as 1,200 pounds of explosives packed inside. 1,200 pounds of explosives packed inside that car bomb in front of the federal building. We heard earlier off the wire that from the governor that some of the fatalities were outside and across the street from the building. Now it all makes sense because the bomb was parked outside in a car. Should we be shocked about a car bomb in Oklahoma City?
Well, any place you have a federal building, you have a target.
That's the question everybody has right now. Why here? Why Oklahoma City? And
And you find out by finding why that building. I don't think it's material that it was in Oklahoma City. It's really the building. The building could have been in any city in the United States. The question is, why that building? And was it Waco? Is it Nation of Islam? We should find out an awful lot when the bombs are taken apart. I think it was a great stroke of luck. As you're mentioning, it's hard to talk about luck on a day like today in Oklahoma City. But it was a great stroke of luck that we actually have got diffused bombs. It's through the bomb material that we will be able to track down who committed this atrocity.
The government didn't do a good job of proving that Terry Nichols was greatly involved in all of this.
I mean, you realize that most people in this country think you're responsible for the bombing, correct?
Correct.
Right. So if your perception is that you didn't get a fair trial, they're saying, so what? In your high school yearbook, you, under future plans, you wrote, and I'm quoting here,
okay,
"Take it as it comes, buy a Lamborghini, California girls." McVeigh was stopped just 75 minutes after the explosion for driving a car without license plates and arrested for carrying a concealed weapon.
All right, everybody. Our next guest is Charles Key, the head of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. Welcome, Mr. Key.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What have we found out with our independent investigation here?
Well, you know, it all started back in 95, of course, when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. I was in the Oklahoma State Legislature for 12 years and lived right here in Oklahoma City, still do, where I've lived for, you know, most of my life. Was a member of the House of Representatives when the bombing occurred, and many people had questions about what happened, not only that day, but as the rescue effort and the investigation unfolded by the government. And then it changed dramatically after the first several days and week. They began to eliminate the causes and perpetrators that they first had talked about, and many others had.
So you caught on that there was something wrong from the very beginning.
Yeah, and, you know, still to this day, people that really paid attention and remember, it's what's interesting is so many people don't remember 8 years ago or don't care. But those that paid attention and remember what happened, they were looking for Middle Eastern terrorists the day of the bombing. They had witnesses that had seen Middle Eastern individuals fleeing the scene of the crime. As time went on, we found witnesses, as other investigators followed up on that and did the same thing, witnesses that saw Timothy McVeigh and the company of Middle Eastern individuals in the days before the bombing and the day of the bombing. The feds would have everybody believe that McVeigh just pulled that truck up by himself, but that's not the case, not the truth. Many witnesses saw him pull the truck up and drive the truck into Oklahoma City that day with a dark-complected, quote, Middle Eastern-looking individual riding in the cab of the truck. And as he pulled it up in front of the building, other vehicles and individuals involved with this crime, very obviously, a brown pickup truck parked and traveling with the Ryder truck as it entered the city, and the yellow Mercury Marquis that's McVeigh's vehicle, had also individuals in those vehicles waiting for him to pull the truck up, leave it in front of the building, and then get away in the Mercury Marquis and, of course, the brown pickup truck. And there was a third vehicle that was part of this, too, a small blue Chrysler product that was carrying individuals that were observing or playing some role in this.
When you say many witnesses, how many witnesses?
Well, you know, if you start backwards from the day of the bombing, of the point of the truck being pulled up, you have about a dozen witnesses that morning, within the couple of hours or hour and a half or so from the time the bomb went off, the one in the truck in the front of the building, you have about a dozen witnesses that had conversations with McVeigh or saw him directly as he pulled up in front of the building, had some kind of encounter with him. about a dozen that, for example, one, two individuals at a tire shop had a conversation with McVeigh, in which they walked up to the cab of the truck and talked to McVeigh and clearly observed within just 8 or 10 feet the individual sitting in the passenger seat in his truck. You have McVeigh pulling the truck up in front of the Regency Towers apartments and getting out to go into the little store that's at the first floor there. That's just the block immediately west of the Murr building, and getting a pack of Marlboro Lights and a couple of cans of pop or something, and an individual sitting in the passenger seat there in the truck just before they pull it up in front of the building. You have another vendor driving a catering-type truck that they cater to employees at work sites, pulling in front of the Murr building just as the Ryder truck had been pulled up and McVeigh and this John Doe get out and start walking north across the street to get in these vehicles that they got into to get away. They walk in front of this catering truck, and he has to throw his brakes on to stop to keep from running over them. And he gets a very good look at them, of course. And again, the list goes on. Those are the kinds of people and encounters that took place that morning. When you go backwards 2 days, 3 days, a week, you come up with another approximately 50 witnesses that had encounters with McVeigh, and all of them, with just maybe three examples, all the rest of them see him with someone or multiple individuals.
Do we know who any of these people are?
Oh, yeah. We've interviewed those people. We've gotten their sworn affidavits, either in written and...
Oh, I don't mean the witnesses. I mean the people that were with McVeigh.
Oh. Well, there have been at least one that has been identified by a independent reporter that used to work for the NBC affiliate here in Oklahoma City. And that NBC affiliate did six or seven different programs, special investigative reports, reporting on these Middle Eastern, former Iraqi soldiers in the first Gulf Desert Storm War that we were engaged in George Bush Sr.'s first term as president, or in his term as president. And they've identified a number of these individuals as apparently being part of this group of Iraqi soldiers that have been allowed to come into this country. And they've named one of them in particular as being the individual who was in the Ryder truck riding with McVeigh as he parked the truck in front of the building, came through Oklahoma City. His name is Ali Husseini Hussein. Ali Husseini Hussein, a former Iraqi soldier.
And he's the guy that you believe was driving the brown pickup truck?
Well, he was driving the brown pickup truck as they got away, but he was also in the Ryder truck in the passenger seat with McVeigh as he pulled it in front of the building. So he pulls it in front of the building. They get out of the Ryder truck. McVeigh goes to his car, in which there was another Middle Eastern-looking individual, according to witnesses. And then Ali Husseini Hussein, who was in the passenger seat of McVeigh's truck, got in the brown pickup truck, according to other witnesses, and fled the scene of the crime.
So
with others in that pickup.
I read in one of the books by Ambrose Evans Pritchard from the Daily Telegraph in London, wrote about there was a video surveillance camera from a topless bar that McVeigh went to, and that reporter named J.D. Cash got the videotape. I guess he got there right before the FBI did, and he got the videotape that had McVeigh with an Iraqi. Is that Al Husseini Hussein? Is it somebody else? Or have you seen that footage? You know what I'm talking about?
And nobody's seen that, to my knowledge, that they were publicly shown it, or, you know, they kept it secret. If it still exists, I'm not even certain if it still exists.
I was under the impression that J.D. Cash got a copy of it.
Well, he may have, but he didn't tell me that he had a copy of it, but he might have. He may be keeping it for some time in the future to spring this thing, just as, you know, we saw the JFK assassination unfold over many years, and the Zapruder film show up, and other many other things, we're going to see, and we have seen, we're going to continue to see things crop up in the Oklahoma City case that's going to continue to fill in pieces of the puzzle.
And that speaking may be of one, missing footage, what about all the surveillance cameras around the building? Do we have those tapes?
No. As a matter of fact, we don't, and we should. You know, in this country, when any crime's committed, like Rodney King gets beat up or any number of other crimes, people pull the surveillance video out, or it's individual camcorders that people pull up and then take it, you know, to the local TV station. They pop it in a VCR or a player, and the All-America can look at it. And you would think that would be the case in the Oklahoma City bombing, at least after the trials took place. But the Justice Department, even in the current Bush administration, has fought every single effort to release those videotapes. And there was even a court case here in Oklahoma City that went on, a federal court case, and it was the outgrowth of a Freedom of Information Act request that the government continued to deny the release of the videotapes. So the plaintiffs brought the case to court, and it went on for a year here in Oklahoma City and ended about 2 years ago. And it was discovered officially through that action that there were at least 22 surveillance videotapes, including ones that were on the Murrah building, right on the front of the building, pointing down towards the street, that would have shown very close view and very clearly and specifically the Ryder truck and the other individuals in these other vehicles.
So they didn't even use this footage at McVeigh's trial?
No. And they fought it all the way through this court case. The Justice Department, after all the trials have been finished, they had no justification to hold on to them, but they kept stonewalling and trying to stop the release of these videos. And they won, at least up to this point, because those that brought the case didn't have the money to continue fighting it, is what the bottom line is. And that's how they often win. They wear you out because of the time and money expense to fight them.
After all, they can force the rest of us to pay all their expenses.
Exactly.
So I guess we should get specific on some topics here. What about the first grand jury? There was some shenanigans going on there with a grand juror by the name of Hoppy Heidelberg. Can you explain some of that?
Well, you know, a federal grand jury is, according to the law, unless it's been changed in the last couple of years, my understanding is that individuals may be called to serve on a federal grand jury, and they are there to serve up to a year, and that could go as long as a year and a half, at the discretion of the federal prosecutors when they need them. And so certain individuals in this particular federal district were chosen to be federal grand jurors when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred. And so the federal prosecutors used those individuals to bring their evidence, to go through the proper procedures to bring charges against those that were responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, one of the members of that group of jurors was a guy named Hoppy Heidelberg here in Oklahoma, and he happened to be an individual that was very intelligent and knowledgeable about his rights as an American citizen and specifically as a juror. And as the evidence was brought before these people that were part of this jury, he and there were about three others began to ask questions instead of just take spoon-fed information from the federal prosecutors and others that came before them. They began to ask questions and also request that they be able to talk to some experts about the forensics of the case, the bomb or the possible use of other bombs in the building, and other facts about witnesses and other information. And they were denied each and every time. Well, Hoppy Heidelberg persisted in requesting and asking these questions until finally one of the federal assistant prosecutors said to him, kind of shrugged, took a deep breath and shrugged, I think it was a female prosecutor, said, "Mr. Heidelberg, would you just write your questions down and submit them to the presiding judge," who was Judge David Russell, still sits on the bench here in Oklahoma in this district. He sent a letter, a real nice letter, to the judge and said, you know, I respectfully submit this information to you that certain individuals, and he named them and went into detail, and other information should be brought before this grand jury, or some other grand jury at least, and explored to their fullest to find out everything we can about this case and bring everybody to justice. And it was very respectful. It was about a two-page letter, as I recall. We've got copies of it in our final report. And the judge responded by simply saying, "Dear Mr. Heidelberg, you are no longer a member of the grand jury. If you speak about anything regarding this case during your tenure as a grand jury, you will be charged, you know, each thing that you discuss as an individual count, and a charge will be brought against you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera," threatening him and trying to silence him completely and totally.
Well, and he was just a grand jury trying to ask some questions, right? What questions was he asking that bothered them so much?
Yeah, and my tenure in the legislature and then involvement in legal issues, and my interest was always with the jury reforms and protecting the jury and things of that nature. I want to emphasize here that he was only doing what he fully had the right to do and every American citizen has the right to do. But they were trying to deny him his constitutional rights to do that, even threatening him. Because he was asking questions about the witnesses, bringing witnesses before them, and experts that could analyze the forensic data and the information that would have addressed the issue, whether or not a truck bomb in front of that building could even have possibly done the damage to that building, which it can't. And he suspected that, like so many people do, and so many experts have claimed that it can't. And he was asking about other things that would have been normal procedural kinds of things that law enforcement usually pursues and follows in trying to find who are the perpetrators of a crime. Like, for example, taking the fingerprints and checking the fingerprints to see if they match up with other known criminal elements or suspects. That was something that was never done in this case, and the defense lawyers in the McVeigh trial were good about making that point in the trial against McVeigh. When the FBI, certain FBI officials were on the stand, they brought this out and established it in the record that the total number of fingerprints that were taken in this case were 1,034. And again, to really emphasize what happened in this case, you have these fingerprints, even ones from McVeigh's car, from the Dreamland Hotel where he stayed several days and nights before the bombing, and someone was there in that room with him, by the way, and even the counter at the Eldon's Body Shop where the Ryder truck was rented, and many other locations. And the FBI never ran those fingerprints against their national database to see if they came up with any matches.
Well, that's funny, because I remember when I went to get my driver's license, I had to put my thumb on a scanner. And I've never even been convicted of anything. I have no criminal record at all, and they have my thumbprints, and this is the biggest crime in the history of the United States, at least up until that point, and they didn't check the fingerprints against the database?
Yeah, it's absolutely, you know, beyond, it's not conscionable that can happen. It doesn't happen, you know. As much as people back on the East and West Coast thinks that Oklahoma, particularly maybe Texas, is flyover country, and we're a bunch of yahoos that maybe don't know what we're doing out here, it doesn't work no matter where you're from, East Coast, West Coast, or Central United States. Law enforcement officials, whether they be local, state, or federal, don't decide on a case-by-case basis, "Gee, Billy Bob, I wonder if we ought to run the fingerprints this time in this murder trial," much less the biggest case in history, as you just said. No, they always, always run the fingerprints. And especially, if that were not the case, they would especially do it in a case like this. They intentionally did not. And that sticks out, just like the surveillance videos being concealed from the public as being evidences of cover-up.
And again, to reiterate, they admitted that they did not under oath during the trial, correct?
They did, absolutely.
Incredible. I just played a clip right before we brought you on the air of Edie Smith saying, "Hey, we're just trying to ask some questions about where was the ATF, and they won't answer us. So now we wonder, where the hell were they?" So now I'm asking you, Charles Key, where was the ATF the morning of the Oklahoma bombing?
Well, that's a good question because they certainly were not in their offices at the very minimum. And this is a real important point because there's so much that's said just kind of out there in the general public about many things when they become suspicious like this case. You know, claims or statements that people make. And I can tell you that we research that as much as anything can be researched. And this is the long and short story on was the ATF in the building when the bomb went off out front. The answer is it's possible that there were two or three agents in the building, but highly unlikely. And I'm going to give you the specifics why. The ATF had their office in the Murrah building. They actually had two employees of the ATF. They were called compliance officers. And those officers that were part of the contingency of employees there in the ATF office, these two compliance officers were not housed in the ATF office. They actually officed in the DEA office for two reasons. Because there was a space problem, and also because their job descriptions fit differently from the rest of the ATF officials and officers there. So they officed in the DEA offices. We know that those two individuals were there when the bomb occurred. They were actually injured significantly, but slightly compared to many other people. So we know those two people were there. Now, as Edie Smith asked that question, it became controversial here in Oklahoma City for many weeks and even months as after the bombing occurred. Pressure was put on the ATF and the federal government to answer specifically, were they there and who were the people that were there? Well, they claimed that there were those two compliance officers and then three other individuals. One of them's named Luke Franey, another one named Valerie Rowden, and a third one named, I'm drawing a blank all of a sudden, but I'll think of it as I tell this story. Those three individuals, Valerie Rowden being basically a secretarial support staff, the other two individuals, men who were field agents, allegedly were in the building, according to the government. But here's what we know about those other two individuals. One of them was told the story that he was in a elevator, that he and another federal employee, a DEA agent, stepped into an elevator just a few minutes before, or a few seconds, I should say, before the truck bomb and the other bombs inside the building went off. And they tell this story in an employee newsletter right after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, before there was too much controversy about this. They claim in this story that they step in this elevator and that it free fell from the 8th floor all the way down to the 3rd floor. That's 5 stories. And that they survived that fall, and they immediately began trying to fight their way out of that elevator because the doors were jammed and they couldn't get out of it. And they claim in the story that after 3 attempts, they were able to force the doors open on the elevator and squeeze out of it and then begin to help in the rescue effort. Well, the elevator technicians that were immediately on the scene, and by the way, that also includes GSA officials that were from Fort Worth who happened to come up that day to do inspections on the building and the elevators, also inspected all elevators after the bombing occurred. The private elevator technicians and the government technicians from GSA all claimed that there was no evidence of any free-falling elevator, no evidence of any elevator where people had broken out of it. And the real telling thing about this story that this one particular agent says is that those same experts and others say that elevators, if you fall in a free fall in the elevator, which is unlikely for some other reasons, but if it were to happen, 5 stories, it would be like jumping off a 5-story building. You would be lucky to survive it, and if you did, you would certainly have some broken bones and very serious injuries to yourself. And neither one of those individuals had any injuries like that.
Well, and not to mention the fact that elevators nowadays have emergency brakes and stuff that would never allow an elevator to free fall 5 stories anyway.
That's true, and these same technicians said that there was no evidence of the brakes some other safety mechanism also that comes in as even a backup to the brakes. None of those were engaged in any elevator, so they found no evidence whatsoever.
Okay, so what about the rest of the ATF? Where were they? Or how many were supposed to be in the building at 9 o'clock that morning, and how many were...
There would have been a total number of employees of 17 or 18. Typically at that time, according to the many people that we interviewed, that it would have been common to have about a dozen, you know, maybe up to 14 or 15 that would have been in the office at that time.
Where were the rest of them?
Well, you've got Luke Franey is another one of these three, the next guy, and he is, some people may remember this, he was about 10:30, the bombing happened at 9:02, at about 10:30 a.m., as all the cameras in the world were on that building, they showed on the back, on the east side of the building, on the ninth floor, an individual with a handmade piece of cardboard where they'd, handwritten, something such as ATF agents stuck up here, please help get me out, something like that. He was showing this card and was eventually assisted in getting out of there. Well, his story is that he was in the building when the bombing occurred and he was knocked unconscious, and then he tried to bust through a door that was jammed or it had debris back and he was holding it back, and he couldn't get through there, so he crawled out a window and went around the face of the building, which, you know, we've always called a Spider-Man act. This is Luke Franey's Spider-Man imitation. And went around to another window into another office and couldn't get out of that one, so he used his martial arts training to bust through a wall and then escape down a stairwell eventually after being stuck up there. Well,
so what's more likely, that or a single truck bomb causing that much damage?
Well, you know, the thing about it is here you have these cameras on this guy that show him with a sign saying, I'm stuck up here, help, you know, somebody give me some assistance or something. And then he claims, and this is in the court record, in the preliminary hearing records up in Denver, Colorado, in the federal case of McVeigh, he claims that after he showed that sign, then he climbs around the face of that building, which, you know, I won't go into detail to explain what it was like, but it would have been extremely, extremely difficult, if not impossible. Most everybody thinks it's impossible for somebody to actually scale that and go around. But the interesting thing is the cameras. No cameras ever caught him going around that. And the cameras were constantly on every side of this building. And then he, you know, makes his way down. You know, I don't know. It's like winning the Texas lottery, probably, you know, on either one of these issues, whether Luke Franey was really there and he could have done these things, or a truck bomb could have done the damage to that building. The odds are that great or greater. I asked General Parton, who's one of the premier experts and has studied this case very extensively and done his own report, about what the odds are of illegally stored munitions, including C4, which is commonly referred to as dynamite, which there was munitions and what have you in the building stored illegally. What were the chances of those going off because of the percussion of the bomb out front and it setting them off and then causing additional damage? And he answered basically the same way, that the odds of that happening are so great that it's highly unlikely. It'd be odds likened to winning the Super Lotto, you know, that just astronomical odds. But then you have this third ATF employee, that Valerie Rowden, and we have one witness, and then this is one that we haven't been able to convince to go on record, but I'm going to tell it on this particular station. I've only told this a few times publicly because of protection of this one witness. There's actually two witnesses that witnessed Valerie Rowden, heard her make this statement at one of the many funerals that was occurring in Oklahoma City as they found various individuals' bodies or what was left of them. Two employees that worked with Valerie Rowden were at a funeral that she attended, and this was in just days after the bombing, or about a week or so, and they approached her after going through the line where people will view a body or pictures or what have you, and they were out in a foyer and they walked up to her and they said, gosh, Valerie, it's good to see you. We were really worried about you. We didn't know if you were in the building when the bombing occurred. We didn't know if you were hurt or didn't make it. Really glad you're okay. And she responded by saying, well, I wasn't in the building that morning, and made a few other comments about where she was. And I tell that story now, and I've told it a few times, because I know the individual that the individuals that had that conversation with her, and I know some other facts about Valerie Rowden and her whereabouts on the day of the bombing, and I'm convinced that she was not there either. So I don't think the ATF was in the building that morning. The hard thing for people to try to come to some understanding of, and I can't say that I have a complete understanding of it myself, is the implication of there not being anyone in the ATF offices that morning. That it gives the appearance that they all knew exactly what was going to happen and they vacated the building to leave everybody else there to be blown up. And I really don't think that that's probably the case either. Now, I don't know exactly what happened, and I think as time goes on, we'll learn more about this as people, either because of their conscience or for other reasons, feel compelled to tell.
Well, it's definitely exactly problematic that agents who clearly weren't in the building are lying and trying to claim that they were.
Absolutely. You know, there's no question about that. And I don't mean to imply that there's some good reason for them not being there. I'm certainly not saying that either. But one thing that happened to us is, and myself, because I was the lead person that was speaking out, other than Edie Smith and two or three other survivors or family members that lost people in the bombing, one thing that happened to us is we spoke out about many of these questions, including the lack of presence in the ATF offices, which would imply that there was some level of prior knowledge. Our governor at the time, Frank Keating, and others really, you know, really highly criticized me and others by suggesting, and they would use language like this, suggesting that we would say that those people would leave everyone else there in the building to be slaughtered. You know, those are the kind of emotional hot button words they would use. And that all of that causes such emotions to go through many people that they don't want to believe that. I mean, who wants to believe that they, you know, your one of your fellow employees or someone, anyone, would vacate a building like that and not warn other people?
Well, and Frank Keating was the former deputy director of the Treasury Department, making him the former boss of the ATF, isn't that right?
Yes. He was an assistant at Justice Department.
And didn't some of the agents admit to people at the scene that they were warned on their pagers not to go to work?
Yes, they absolutely did. We have documented cases, affidavits from emergency personnel that had conversations with ATF agents and overheard ATF agents in other cases, or had conversations with other federal or state law enforcement officials that were talking about the pages that they received or, you know, information that they had.
Well, and Congressman Istook said that he was warned, and Judge Wayne Alley told the Portland Oregonian that he was warned, and even more, right?
Yeah, that's true. And so the evidence is overwhelming that there was some level of prior knowledge. But again, the reason I said that a minute ago is knowing exactly what any or everyone knew is the, you know, one of the big questions. I've learned that it's not that hard to cover up. I used to be one many years ago that thought, well, they couldn't, you know, they, in any particular case, would be too hard for people to cover things up because somebody would just come out and talk. Well, I've gotten a real education. That's not how it is. It's real easy to cover things up because people will go along with a cover-up because of fear for their own lives, or in some cases just fear for losing their jobs, or fear of public ridicule. And so it's not hard at all. I've had too many federal agents or employees tell me information about this bombing case and say, now, if you ever use my name, I will, you know, I will not admit it and then call you a liar if I have to. But here's the case, here's the truth about certain aspects of this bombing. So, you know, the people will keep their mouths shut to keep their jobs, or in their view, because they fear for their lives, they think something will happen to them. So it's not hard to do.
Well, I thought that was part of the reason somebody signed up for the FBI, because they would even put their life on the line in order to see that justice is done.
Yeah, well, if those days were ever real, or really it was ever really like that, I don't think they're here anymore. There might, now, I think there's a lot of good FBI agents out there. I don't have any doubt about that. But as a whole, the agency because of the way it's been captured and controlled from a political point of view, from a political perspective, and from high above, it's been taken under control and compartmentalized, and agents in the field no longer run the agency in the sense that their work and what they do in the field in trying to find truth and justice and bring true criminals to justice oftentimes does not follow its natural course, because those up above are filtering the information and it's being handled in ways that thwarts justice. And that's even the statements of many FBI agents. Even recently in Dallas, you guys have in Texas there a really excellent program that's aired through the PBS affiliate in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And they recently did 2 one-hour shows on the Oklahoma City bombing. And the FBI agent that they had there is one of the guests of the program, Danny Colson, I think is very misinformed and got a lot of things wrong. On the other hand, he got a lot of things right, and I think he's trying to do the right thing, at least in some cases. He admitted that the FBI is no longer the agency it once was, and it needs to be totally, totally restructured and reformed because it no longer can carry out its normal, natural function like it needs to.
Well, and that just makes me wary that they're just going to reorganize it and make it worse, and we'll have 10 more Oklahoma bombings.
Well, look what we got. We got the Homeland Security Office, and we got more agents put on the streets, and we get more laws that are passed, and I put that in quotation marks, as if you can pass a law that violates a superior law called a constitutional law. But they've done that with the Patriot Act, and now they've got this Patriot Number 2 Act that they're out there trying to pass, and many others. And
seems like the more we complain that they let these attacks take place, the more they say, gee, you're right, and if only we had more power, we could have stopped it.
Yeah,
they did that after the Oklahoma bombing, right? Didn't they pass a new anti-terrorism law?
Right, and they did it after 9/11. And, here's one thing I'd like, to your listeners out there, and I hope there are a lot of young people, that's the impression I've gotten, maybe not, but, think back in the days of the 60s with all the protest and involvement of young people at high school, college age, and young adults that were really rocking the boat and trying to make some things happen and bring about some real meaningful reforms. I grew up in those times. I'm 49, and I look around today, and I'm not saying this as just a general criticism of all young people, but I don't see that kind of interest in activism that there was back then, and that's very powerful. And I would encourage and ask young people to get involved and force change, because there's a gate being put up around all of us Americans, and it's corralling everybody in, and it's getting ready to be completed, and the gate's going to be, the fence is being put up, and it's going to be completed, and there's going to be a fence all the way around us, and people will wake up and notice it at some point and wonder how it happened and want to do something about it then, when it's going to be much harder to do anything about it, when the price to pay to do something about it will be much more harsh. And now there's still opportunity to do something about this fence that's being put up all around us. And I mean that figuratively, in that these laws are being passed to make it difficult to speak out, difficult to take actions, difficult to travel, difficult to do many things that we've been taking for granted for a long time. And we need young people who have the energy and the idealism and care about freedom, real freedom, to stand up and start fighting for these principles that this country's all about.
Before it's too late to be able to fight.
Yep.
Let's get back to General Parton for a second here. How many bombs does he say were in the building?
He thinks there's about 3 or 4. He's got specific locations in his report that he thinks there were particular places that columns were taken out. And in a simple layman's type of a view of why the truck bomb couldn't work, and that's where I had to come from, because I didn't have any expertise in these disciplines. I had to depend on General Parton and others. And then kind of go through a cram course of learning why we can look at the after effects of a bombing like this and determine what happened and what did not happen, what could have done it, what could not have done it. And, you know, another thing important before we get into the details of this to understand is that commercial application of ammonium nitrate used as a explosive device is very extensive. It's been going on for a long time. Military application of it. There's been many tests, many extensive tests of using all kinds of explosive devices on what they call hard targets. A hard target is something like steel-reinforced concrete structures like the Murrah Building. And then the analysis of actual terrorist acts that have occurred all over this world by our own military and investigative branches of the government. So we've got a wealth of information about what works and what doesn't work and how they work. And General Parton is one of the top experts in our country, in the world even, about how these work, and he studied them for many years. And he's called by other experts an expert. So he knows what he's talking about. It is pretty much this simple. If you pull up any, if you set any bomb next to a hard concrete steel reinforced structure and you place it close to it, let's say within feet or within 10 feet or 15 or 20 feet, when that explosive device goes off, the pressure, the power that it has reduces greatly as you go out away from the epicenter of that bomb. And I liken it to those of us that have grown up and played with firecrackers, you know, during every year, 4th of July. You take any kind of, like a black cat firecracker. If you were to lay that right on the table here where I'm sitting talking to you on the phone and lit the fuse of a black cat firecracker, it's going to make a loud noise and scare anybody that's around, but it won't hurt you. But if you lay it in your hand and set it off, you'll feel a sting. Now, if you hold it between your fingers and grasp it and put, a reasonable amount of pressure on it to hold it in your hand and set it off, it's going to really hurt you. And then if you take it a step further, if you were to take, say, a paper cup or a plastic cup, and you take that black cat firecracker and you attach it to that cup by, say, with a rubber band or something, and set it off, it might blow a hole in a paper cup. If you lay it next to a paper cup, it won't. It might move the cup. And the principles are the same. If you take a bomb and you set it 10 or 15 feet away from a steel-reinforced structure, including the columns and the beams that put that make that structure what it is, the pressure to blow those beams down, to blow those columns down, is not sufficient enough. You have to take it, just like when they do demolitions of buildings around the country. We've all seen this on TV or heard about it. They don't just put a bomb close to it. They take the bombs and they strap them on the columns, and most of the time they actually drill holes into the columns, place the dynamite or the C4 or other explosive device inside the column so that they can destroy the column so it will then fall down, because otherwise it will not do it. And it's that simple in regards to this case. You can't drive a ammonium nitrate bomb, even as some of the government experts that analyzed this later said, that to even come close to doing the damage to that building, you'd have to have something about four times the size, at least, of what was in that truck in front of the building to come close to start doing damage to the building. So that begs the question, how was that much damage and the pattern of damage, which are two very important different points, the amount of damage and the pattern of damage in that building, to accomplish that. And experts like General Parton and others have analyzed this. They've looked at the photos. They've looked at the remains of the building. They've identified the various columns in the rubble and the header beams in front on the front part of the building, and been able to analyze the way they broke the damage to the individual beams and columns. And because of their many years of analyzing things like that, they can tell by the breaks on these columns whether they were done because they failed because they of other things involved, or whether or not an explosive device actually, you know, shattered them and caused them to fail. And they come to the conclusion that there had to be other explosive devices inside the building to supplement the pattern of damage and the amount of damage that was done to the building. And there really can be practically no doubt about it. We've not found any expert, and we've talked to many, and included a half a dozen of them in our report that we did, including General Parton. We've not found any experts that were willing to put their professional opinions and their name on the line by saying, here's another way that this could have happened, other than additional explosive devices.
So the only people who disagree with General Parton's conclusions is the FBI.
Yeah, and they won't even, they don't go into any kind of detail. They don't go into any kind of counter explanation to say how it can work. Now, what happened in this case with this issue and just about everything else, the witnesses, the prior knowledge, the Middle Eastern connection, they would float information out through the press, and then the press would go out and say, our sources tell us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I learned this the hard way, that the FBI and the government in general has become experts in using the press to float the stories they want to float without ever having to take responsibility for those specific topics or various issues that they happen to, quote, float out there. And I'm going to use an example here. In the case of the other bombs being used in the building, what they did is they floated this story that, well, I'll tell another one first that kind of precedes everything. Some people will remember that there were, help me, Philip, I'm forgetting the terminology, the devices that record the...
The seismographs. The
seismographs. Yeah, I just drew a blank there. There were three different seismographs that recorded the various events, explosive events that took place. The truck bomb and then the others inside the building. And then the falling of the debris on the ground. What the government did right off the bat is they seized the original seismographs from the OU Geological Center, and they claim that the multiple events that are shown on those seismographic records was first the truck bomb and then the debris falling down and hitting the ground. And that was proven to be totally false when they did the demolition of the building 33 days later, which is another topic altogether, why that needed to be done before it was properly analyzed. But then people remember they brought that building down, and they came in with, they had a professional company come in and bring it down, a demolition. And when they did that, they put additional seismographs up around the immediate area to record it. Well, the record of the demolition showed no events at all when the remainder of the building came down, which was about three times as much as what came down in the Oklahoma City bombing. So in other words, their claim that, well, it was debris coming down from the building was what the other events were, was totally something to float out there to cover up and try to put down any talk of other bombs being built, being used in the bombing.
And even though the seismograph experts have maintained for 8 years straight now that this is multiple bombs going off here, correct?
Exactly. And they float that out there, and a lot of people in the general public believe it because most people don't pay that much attention anyway, and a lot of people want to believe what the government tells them. That they wouldn't lie, they think that they wouldn't lie to them, and that if they get some nice pat answers, it makes everybody feel comfortable. They can go around with their daily lives and not have to worry about anything. But it's one of the ways they float information, and they did it time after time in the Oklahoma City case. And a lot of times they would do it with the media, because the media, what I found out and realized as time went on, as we were very public with this, most people don't realize to the extent that it was a very public thing here in Oklahoma. It was almost weekly news, week after week for about 3.5 years. And when various things would develop in the Oklahoma City case, they would come and interview me, usually, in addition to that, maybe Glenn Wilburn, and then maybe one or two other family members, survivors, And then they'd always go interview, of course, the FBI and any federal prosecutor in the case. They'd get, you know, these different sides of the story from the various issues or topics that were up at the time. And so I would end up speaking with a lot of the media regularly, week after week, after, you know, sometimes many times during the week. And so we'd have these off-the-record conversations in which the media would tell me, well, they're hearing from the federal prosecutors that X, Y, or Z or ABC or whatever, again, depending on the topic. And then I'd see the, I would see, and everybody would see, what would be reported by the media. And you start getting the picture, you realize that a lot of what the media talks about is what they get fed to them by the government. You know, the government is the ultimate source of information. They're the only source. And so all the various media entities, they compete for the government's favor because there's no other place to go to get information about the crime that just took place, for example, or other events that are going on. So they would go out and echo whatever the government might tell them that, you know, you might have an FBI agent or prosecutor might say confidentially, well, look, off the record, don't mention my name, but here's what we've learned that happened, is that when the truck bomb went off, it lifted those floors up because of all the power that it had, and it caused them to be kind of lifted and then fall back down, and that's what caused this pancaking of the floors and the building falling down like it did, which is bogus. But then they went out in the media and talked about that. And that's what stuck in so many people's minds. Is, well, okay, that's what happened. That's how it did it. That's how that truck bomb did all that damage. And then people just buy these stories like that.
Mr. Key, we've only got about 8 minutes left, so I want to get to a couple of things here real quick. The official story is that McVeigh and Terry Nichols built this ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb at Geary State Lake. Where's Geary State Lake?
Geary State Lake is several miles south of Junction City, Kansas, where McVeigh and Nichols were stationed in the Army. And likewise, it's a few miles north of Harrington, Kansas, where Terry Nichols lived at the time.
How far away is that from Oklahoma City?
That's about a three-hour drive straight through.
So McVeigh supposedly drove this liquid bomb in the back of a big dually truck. How many hundred miles?
Gosh, you have to forgive me. I forget the miles now, but it's about a three and a half hour drive. You know, and that's after they, according to the feds, which is, I believe, another bogus story to make their case work out like they wanted it to, they would have made the bomb about 18 hours before the bombing occurred, maybe 20 or so hours before the bombing occurred. And allegedly, McVeigh and Nichols make it themselves out at this lake, which raises all kinds of questions, whether or not they have the physical ability to actually do it all. Two men in, you know, many 55-gallon barrels, dumping all these bags of ammonium nitrate, somehow mixing diesel in with it, and then stirring it and mixing it, all of that being done in the back of a truck, maneuvering all that around and doing all that. It's almost seems like an impossibility in and of itself, but that's allegedly the story, is that they made it the late afternoon, early evening before, and then McVeigh drove it down by himself to Oklahoma City.
Do you have any comment on the connections between Timothy McVeigh and the neo-Nazis at Elohim City?
Well, there's no question that he had been in contact and even visited Elohim City. He even made a phone call to Andy Strassmeyer, the West German military officer that had been staying there for quite some time, and no doubt had a role in this bombing or some type of played some part in it in some way or another. Made a call to Strassmeyer several days before the Oklahoma City bombing into Elohim City. So I'm not sure if McVeigh really was a neo-Nazi or what. That's always been questionable in my mind, but there's no question in my mind that he associated with them and worked with a lot of those people. Now, what's interesting is I mentioned this PBS program, 2-hour programs that ran on the McQuestion and Company program out of Dallas, Fort Worth area. It's called McQuestion and Company. People might want to look that up. Stephen Jones was also on there, the attorney for McVeigh. And he clearly said, and he said this before, that he doesn't believe that McVeigh was the ringleader of this whole bombing operation, that he was just a worker, what's sometimes called a mule. He was somebody there just to drive a truck or to come, do something. And that it's a very, very strong possibility that McVeigh didn't even really know that there was going to be that great of an explosion to do that much damage.
Well, and in Stephen Jones' book, he says that he took Timothy McVeigh's recipe for the bomb to the Scotland Yard, and that they joked, well, is your client still alive? And Stephen Jones said, yes, he is. And they said, well, then he didn't make this bomb, much less drive it 200-something miles from Kansas to its target.
Yep.
Without blowing himself up on the way.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Jones has actually done tremendous work and has really gone far beyond what anybody would be expected to go to stick his neck out personally and his career, put his career on the line to say a lot of things that need to be said and call a lot of these government officials essentially liars and lawbreakers. And he's done some tremendous work. He thinks there were quite a number of other people involved. He has no doubt about that. And I think from comments that he's made and others and the facts of this case, that it's questionable whether or not McVeigh really was playing the role of a bomber, that he might have been a patsy altogether, a lot like a Lee Harvey Oswald, and that he might have thought that he was carrying out some act on behalf of our government, and that he got caught up and got blamed for this and decided that he would take the route that he took to try to claim credit for the whole thing.
Well, now you just open up a whole can of worms. We got 3 minutes here. Now, wait a minute. Okay, my understanding from reading The Secret Life of Bill Clinton by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, his whole first section is on the Oklahoma City bombing. And he talks in there about how the ATF was prepared to raid Elohim City and how Bob Ricks, who we all remember was the spokesman for the FBI during the Waco massacre, Bob Ricks was in charge of the Tulsa office, and how he told the ATF to back off, that the FBI would handle it. And now you just went and said something about McVeigh may have thought he was working for the government. Do we know which agency he may have thought he was working for, or actually was?
Let me try to get this in the last time we have, and I'd be glad to come back another time and talk about this. But
I'd be glad first to have
all,
you back.
First of all, you know, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, a great guy. I met him, he wrote that book way early on in this whole case, like in, I think it's 96 or 7. That was 96, I believe. And so his information was put together back then, and it was good information, but we've learned a lot more since then. The reason I say that is because Timothy McVeigh was real close to his younger sister, Jennifer, as many people know that have looked in this case. One of the letters that he wrote to Jennifer that's been put out in public and was even, I think it might have been used in one of the trials, parts of it. He says in that letter to her that after he was still in the military, in the Army, he says essentially, and these are my words because I don't remember exactly how it read, but he said, I'm being recruited to be part of a covert military black ops kind of an operation that would do drug interdiction and even, I think it said, assassination of drug warlords or drug kingpins or something along that lines. Well, you know, McVeigh was not known as a guy that went around boasting or lying, that he was a facts-only kind of guy, need-to-know basis. And if he said that, he did say that to his sister in a letter, well, what did that mean? And was he eventually brought into this secret, you know, under the official, officialdom and military and law enforcement, the federal government, brought into this organization like this to carry out various kinds of acts, and who knows what they might include? Was he participating in something that was not really just an act to try to get back at the federal government? We may never know that, but that letter and other things raise legitimately, I think, that question for speculation.
That's something we really got to dig more into, especially with the fact that Andre Strassmeyer was no neo-Nazi at all. He was clearly an Army intelligence officer from Germany working for either the FBI or somebody in our government.
Right, and I'm glad you said that, because in this context, he is another reason why this possible topic along this bigger subject of the Oklahoma City bombing is legitimate and should be explored, because there was a lot more going on here than just some guys that were mad at the government, and somehow our law enforcement blew it literally and figuratively by not stopping this thing before it happened. There's a lot more to the story.
And 168 dead, right? Or 169 if you count the extra leg?
Yeah, and/or the unborn baby, as some people want to count. And then there's a rescue worker that died, and a nurse, a woman that had some debris fall on her head, and she eventually died from that injury.
Okay, Mr. Key, we're out of time. We're going to have to continue this some other time. We're not done with this story at all.
Appreciate what you're doing there, and I'm glad to be on your show, and I hope you do a lot of good things there, and I'll be glad to come back anytime.
Thank you so much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been
OKCBombing.org.
And the book is The Final Report of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee.
That's correct.
Thanks so much for coming on the air today, sir.
You bet. Take care.
Here's the truth. And the truth.
CBS News poll out this morning finds 53% of Americans believe questions about what happened in Oklahoma City will continue.
Kathy, I know you have been so concerned about this execution because you've spent the recent years of your life looking into whether or not there was a conspiracy that was larger than just McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and a couple of others. Do you feel any differently now, having seen this or having gone through the execution this morning?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, this was just a bump in the road on just a bump in the road to me. I feel absolutely no different. There absolutely were other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've been working with MGA Films the last 2 years, and we're going to be releasing a documentary entitled A Cry for Justice, The Untold Story, and I think the American people are going to be surprised at what they're going to see.
Clearly there's a conspiracy of some 6 to 8 people, with perhaps another half dozen inadvertently helping. That is to say, they didn't precisely know what the objective was.
Agents forewarned about a bomb in Oklahoma City. Did they know the Murrah Building was a target? The ATF says no, absolutely not. But tonight in the story you'll see only on the news channel, you're about to hear otherwise from people who were at the Murrah Building that morning.
We asked some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know. Where the hell were they?
The news channel did ask for a private meeting with ATF officials to discuss the credibility of these witness reports, but the ATF refused, saying they had no more to say on the subject.
Hi, this is you. Oh, gee, Bill Clinton was so much better than George W. Bush. So much better.
What he told him is that he thought that they had received a tip that morning of the bomb.
Yet another witness, a rescue worker, says after she talked with an agent at the bombing scene, she also suspected the ATF was warned and agents stayed away from their office that morning.
I asked him if his office was in the building, and he said yes, and I asked if there were any ATF agents that were still in the building, and he said no, we weren't here.
Witness number one approached an ATF agent nearby. He claims he asked the agent what had happened, and witness number one says this is what the agent told him.
He started getting a little bit nervous. He tried reaching somebody on the two-way radio. Couldn't get anybody, and I told him I wanted an answer right then. He said they were in the briefing. None of the agents had been in there. They had been tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day. Plain as day, out of his mouth. They were tipped. Why wasn't anybody else? There was a lot of people, good people, died down there. And if they knew, they should have let everybody else know.
I
last seen, McVeigh was with another person.
Do you have any doubt in your mind that there was a passenger in the Ryder truck?
That's even more. I have no doubt. There was definitely a second person, no matter what. There was two people in this vehicle.
John Doe number two, and there was a $2 million price put on his head. And now they're saying there's no John Doe number two.
And our witnesses picked out a photo lineup. The news channel shared the information and surveillance tapes of this man with the FBI. They've had some of that material long before our reports went on the air.
In the building. And I was looked out the window and I seen a delivery truck and I seen the man get out of the delivery truck.
She was just 10 feet away from the man depicted in this sketch when he stepped out of the Ryder truck.
He was olive complexion and he was, he had black curly hair. He was wearing the baseball cap, but his curls were sticking out of his head. He was short in the back, but you could still see the curls in his hair. He was not American. He was foreign. You can tell by his skin, his face, the way his face was.
We asked FBI Dan Vogel if John Doe number two is still part of the investigation. Does he exist? The answer, yes. The FBI is still trying to locate and identify John Doe number two. The man in our reports is Iraqi. Today, the FBI says they are not pursuing a Middle Eastern connection. This doesn't mean it has been ruled out. That could change tomorrow.
And the details are chilling. We'll also focus on surveillance cameras, cameras that caught the bombing on tape, and maybe the men behind the bombing. The news channel has new information tonight that there's a chance surveillance tapes could be the smoking gun evidence. Now, we asked candid questions in a rare face-to-face meeting with ATF officials close to the investigation. We learned that video collected from downtown businesses the morning of April 19th may someday be played before a jury. Officials won't say who or what exactly is on the tape. However, numerous sources have confirmed the tapes exist and that they reveal more than one bomber.
So what evidence are they asking for? They're asking for video taken from the Ryder trucks from the Rigi Towers.
Well, Kevin, it's a question we've all been asking. We've been asking that question since we first broke the story that surveillance cameras aimed at the federal building could have captured all those involved on tape. Now, sources have confirmed those tapes exist and that they show more than one bomber. The FBI also confirmed those tapes exist when they refused to release them, claiming the video is part of a criminal investigation. And now, for the first time, we get an on-the-record response from the head of the Dallas office, ATF. We learn that videotape could be unveiled as part of the prosecution's case. No officials will discuss specifically what's on the video, but we have been able to recreate some of what may have been captured by downtown surveillance cameras through the eyes of the witnesses. Now, you're looking at a computer recreation of the final movements of the Ryder truck, according to the people who crossed its path at 5th and Harvey, moments before the explosion. Tonight at 10, the witnesses will detail their memories of how they believe the suspects carried out the crime and made their getaway. Now, all these accounts share a common and unsettling similarity. The witnesses say they saw several accomplices, including the infamous John Doe number two. ATF officials tell us the elusive John Doe is still part of this case, but will not comment any further. However, they did tell us that there's a lot about this case we don't know yet, information you can't find in the indictments against Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier.